This is only a game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Okay, okay. One more time.
Back to Folk. Red Sox fans have longed to hear it. The Boston Red Sox are world champions.
The Boston Red Sox captured the World Series by beating the St. Louis Cardinals on Wednesday night to complete a 4-0 run and an 8-game winning streak that began when the Sox beat the New York Yankees in Game 4 of the American League Championship Series. At the press conference after Wednesday night's clincher in St. Louis, Red Sox manager Terry Francona was not inclined to credit mystical forces or the total eclipse of the moon that occurred that night. He was talking fundamentals and timing.
What it really comes down to is having really, really good pitchers follow the game plan and are able to follow it. And the other thing is, sometimes in a short series, you catch guys at the right time. And again, we won tonight. You know, Roland, those guys are going to get hot. We didn't allow them the chance to get hot. So, good for us.
Good for the Sox and for their fans everywhere, but especially for the fans in Boston. On the field, minutes after the fourth game ended with Edgar Renteria's comeback to Keith Foulke, who tossed the ball to Doug Mintkiewicz at first, Mintkiewicz demonstrated his understanding of what the championship meant.
It's crazy, crazy. It's about time. It's for all the guys that went through what they went through last year, to all the teams that couldn't quite get it done, it's to a bunch of fans that now they have nothing to complain about. It's awesome. It couldn't happen to a better city.
Back in Boston, the Sox 3-0 win in Game 4 set off the requisite celebration in Kenmore Square. Happily, the damage was kept to a minimum, though there were a number of arrests and injuries. Among the revelers were Greg and Anne-Marie Carlson. Greg works the door at a pub near Fenway Park. He and his wife were asked when they thought things might return to normal in the neighborhood.
There'll be nothing normal about this. We just won the World Series in our generation. We made history tonight. And you'll never see it like this again, ever, ever, will you see this.
Excellent. It's a dream!
For the past three mornings, Red Sox fans have been waking up to find that the dream is real. Some of them, actually lots of them, have taken pen in hand to commemorate this World Series, and most of those folks have sent their efforts along to only a game. Milton Brasher Cunningham is one of them. His homage to Ernest Lawrence Thayer ends this way. Oh, somewhere there are Yankee fans still crying in their beer. Somewhere there are Cardinal fans. They're waiting for next year. On Lansdowne Street and Yawkey Way, the party has begun. There is finally joy in Mudville, for the Sox have finally won. Joining me now on the line for the final time this season is ESPN's Tim Kirkjian. Tim, you stunned us last week when you declared that the Yankees were no longer the Yankees. Dare I ask whether you think the Red Sox are still the Red Sox?
They're not the Red Sox anymore, Bill. Those days are over. The Red Sox fans have no one to answer to anymore. They don't have to take gruff from anybody on anything anymore. The curse is officially over. Their problems with the Yankees are officially over. But I maintain that there's going to be joy in Boston instead of this. What do we have to complain about now? I think everyone's been waiting so long for this. There'll be a euphoric time in Boston, and there should be.
It's often difficult to distance oneself from an exciting postseason and to put the whole thing into context. But I'm going to ask anyway, would you rank what the Red Sox did in 2004 in the postseason among the greatest runs in Major League Baseball history?
Well, Bill, I don't think I'm overstating this, that this is the greatest story ever told in the history of Major League Baseball. When you consider all the factors, you consider what happened last year with Aaron Boone, what happened in the offseason with Alex Rodriguez, what happened all season with the Red Sox and the Yankees, what's happened for almost 100 years with the Red Sox and the Yankees. And then you take, by definition, the largest collapse in the history of baseball, and at the same time, of course, the largest comeback in the history of baseball. The World Series perhaps paled by comparison, but at least it was an extension of the greatest story ever told, and I really don't think there's any way around that.
Are Cubs fans inspired or discouraged by what the Red Sox did this season?
Well, they should be inspired because they know that really and truly there is no such thing as a curse. And if there is, it can be broken, and it has been broken. So I think Cub fans should all look at it that way and say, all right, next year it's our turn. But what the Cubs need to do, of course, is find a group of guys like the Red Sox. And I don't want to get corny about this, Bill, but chemistry, camaraderie, all that stuff, it works. It works in baseball. I'm the biggest numbers guy in the world, but all the numbers in the world don't measure everything that went into that Red Sox team, including a guy bleeding out of his sock. All of that works into the formula. The formula was perfect for the Red Sox this year, and I was just dazzled by what they did in October.
Tim, I've gone some time in this conversation without mentioning what is perhaps the most significant matter. You predicted this year's World Series champion. That must be nice for a change.
Well, I did that at the beginning of the year, Bill.
Yeah.
How about that? Of course, I picked them to beat the Phillies in the World Series. Phillies didn't even make the playoffs and fired their manager, so let's leave it at that. But I also picked the Red Sox to win the World Series before the playoffs began, and I had them beating the St. Louis Cardinals, and I got every round right in the playoffs. So that was pretty good. Of course, I had the Red Sox winning in seven games. I just couldn't imagine a sweep, but I also couldn't imagine the St. Louis Cardinals, frankly, playing as poorly as they did for four games. The Red Sox deserve everything that they get. They were clearly the better team, but I guarantee you, Bill, the best of the St. Louis Cardinals did not show up for the World Series.
Well, help me understand that a little bit, Tim. What happened to the Cardinals?
Bill, this is one of those inexplicable things which makes baseball the greatest game in the world. Coming into the World Series, the 3-4-5 hitters on the Cardinals, statistically, there had never been a 3-4-5 hitters in any World Series to match Albert Pujols, Scott Rolen, and Jim Edmonds. Never. I did all the research. And yet, that group got stopped 6-for-45 by the Boston pitching. So in the end, instead of me saying, you know, the Cardinals choked and their hitters can't hit, I'm going to say that Pedro Martinez and Derek Lowe and Curt Schilling, three 20-game winners or former 20-game winners, just shut the lights out. I can't believe it happened. But again, it's one of those inexplicable things that makes the game so great.
Well, neither Tony La Russa nor any of his players on the Cardinals seem to be able to explain it either. Is that surprising to you?
No, it was, well, they were just stunned. They were like me. I covered the National League Championship Series, so I missed out in history in the American League. But I wrote, after the Cardinals beat the Astros, that the Cardinals are the most complete, well-rounded, fundamentally sound team in Major League Baseball and have been all year. And then they proceeded to run the bases like a guy who had had a few too many drinks. They didn't hit. Their starting pitching was horrible. And their bullpen, which had been great, wasn't very good either. So I don't know what happened to them from the day the League Championship Series ended to the day the World Series started. But that wasn't the same team. And don't tell me they were tight or they had stage fright or anything else. Again, really good teams like the Red Sox, who are destined to do great things, can do strange things to other teams.
Talk has already begun regarding the Cardinals' pursuit of free agents in the offseason, Tim. Can St. Louis hope to compete with the gigantic wallets of New York, Boston, Atlanta, and Los Angeles?
I think St. Louis is going to have some trouble this offseason. They are going for pitching, and I know they would love to get Randy Johnson, which will not be easy, but they're going to take several of their pitchers, Matt Morris, Woody Williams, I believe, and just let them go and start over with some new pitching, perhaps some more dominant pitching. But to say anybody is going to be able to compete with the Yankees and really compete with the Red Sox in the offseason, I think it's going to be very difficult because it's still, Bill, all about money, and the Yankees have more than anyone else, and the Red Sox aren't significantly behind in number two position.
Tim Kirkjian covers baseball for ESPN and ESPN the magazine. Thanks again, Tim.
Okay, Bill, thank you.
As I mentioned a few minutes ago, this week lots of listeners indicated in their correspondence a propensity to see the World Series in poetic, or at least literary, terms. Rick Beyer of Lexington, Massachusetts, noting that Game 2 of the Cardinals-Red Sox series occurred on the 589th anniversary of an occasion immortalized by Shakespeare, adapted the King's speech from Henry V to read, "We few, we happy few, we band of brothers, for he today that sheds his blood to pitch shall be my brother, be he ne'er so vile, this day shall gentle his condition. And gentlemen in pinstripes, now abed, shall think themselves accursed they were not here, and hold their manhoods cheap whiles any speak that fought with us upon St. Crispin's Day." Also of a literary turn of mind was Stephen J. McGuire of Framingham, Massachusetts. His missive reads in part, "Soon after the fall of Gotham was a final battle by the great river, Their Slaughter, Gibson, and Pujols perished under a dark full moon. So began baseball's third age. Paul Deering, who hears only a game on WXXI AM in Rochester, New York, noticed the moon as well. His email reads, "Wednesday night we witnessed a total eclipse of the babe." Joe Manning of Florence, Massachusetts, wrote to connect the series to prose any parent is likely to know. "Pesky Bucky Buckner Boone, these words no longer fit the tune. Goodbye, curse. Good night, moon." Lisa Janice Cohen, a WBUR listener, emailed to express her gratitude to the Red Sox. "I have watched the Sox play all season," she wrote. "At a certain point, I realized the players were having fun. I was having fun. It was like being let in on an inside joke. Thank you, Red Sox." Fans of the Red Sox, Cardinals, or even the Devil Rays or the Brewers can reach us via our website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.vu.edu. Our non-cyber address is onlyagame, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860.
2 years later, lost first place. Then we watched as Carlton yelled out, "Go, go, go,
Bucky Dent, it's a fly ball.
Sails over the wall.
If the wind was in, the shortstop would have caught it.
And now we have another chance to end the curse. We're in the lead and we need one more out. Could this be the moment we have waited for all these years? Or will this two-run game turn into one more rout?"
It's 18 minutes past the hour. The folks who run the Grand Rapids Rampage of the Arena Football League could be forgiven for wishing to forget about last season. The Rampage went 1-15 and ranked last in nearly every offensive category. Apparently figuring it's no use denying that last year's team was awful, the Rampage will try to turn lemons into lemonade, in a manner of speaking. The team's drive to sell season tickets rewards each buyer with a roll of toilet paper, each sheet of which bears the message 1-15. The package containing the toilet paper is festooned with a message that reads, "It's time to put last season behind us." I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, we'll peer into a business comprised of equal parts hard work and fantasy. But first, you'd have to believe in curses and live under an eclipsed red moon to have missed the fact that the presidential election is coming up. Oh, wait. Well, it is possible sports fans of all kinds, even NBA players who begin their season on Tuesday, Election Day, will remember to head to the voting booth before lacing up their sneakers. Certainly Golden State Warriors center Adonal Foyle will encourage that behavior. He spent the last 3 years involving young people in politics with his nonpartisan group, Democracy Matters. He joins me now on the line. Adonal Foyle, welcome to Only a Game.
My pleasure to be here.
NBA players haven't always been known for political activism. What provoked your interest in politics?
I'm not sure if it's just, I think, coming from the Caribbean and just being very political down there myself and seeing my family being very political. And I think in part because the moment a law is passed, you can feel it the next day when you come from an island of about 500 people. But I think more than that is that my time at Colgate University, upstate New York, I felt that there was a disconnect between what people were saying about young people, which is that they're apathetic. That didn't quite jive with what I saw there, which was a lot of people were going to soup kitchen. They were working for Habitat for Humanity. So they were doing a lot of service learning stuff, which with an apathetic generation, you wouldn't see that kind of stuff. So I felt that there was something more profound was going on, which was that young people, for the most part, believe that they don't have a role to play in the political system because politicians don't talk to them, don't cater to them, and don't think that they're capable of making decisions that affect them except how much beer they're going to have on a Saturday night or a Friday night. So I think it's kind of this thing, why would I pay attention to stiff politicians when they don't even know if I exist or not?
I can understand how you might have gotten that feeling coming out of Colgate. I'm wondering how many players in the locker room in the NBA will join in lively political debate.
I think that is more a product of our environment. I think one of the things that has happened, especially the war in Iraq, when Steve Nash wore a T-shirt that said shoot for peace during the All-Star game, people came down on him extremely hard. And I think that kind of scared people back into their own space of just play sports and shut up and don't give us any political postulation or what have you. Just, you know, just play sport and don't do anything else. So I think you get people are scared into silence a little bit. And I think in also in part is that, you know, there is a financial cost if you're too political or if you're too controversial.
In other words, you might lose endorsements if you're not seen as appealing to a great range of people.
Exactly.
Yeah. More recently, in the aftermath of the Red Sox winning the World Series, Curt Schilling snuck in a vote for Bush message in at least one post-game interview. Is it a good idea for sports figures to be endorsing candidates?
I'm not sure about the endorsement of them. I think more clearly everybody has an opinion, and insofar that they do, why not? They certainly are entitled to do that. But to me, the more important thing is that there's a whole range of issues when it comes to picking a candidate. And to simply just, you know, do a tagline that says vote for Kerry or vote for Bush, I think missed the mark, because people are struggling with a lot of these different issues. So to me, a much more important way to do that would be to say, okay, what are the issues that you're concerned about? What are the concerns for you in this general election? And let's talk about those and see what the candidate that best support these ideologies or best support these ideas and be able to put them into practice. To me, there's really too much at stake to just simply do a tagline or a vote for. I think it's much more profound than that, and it warrants a lot more debate.
Do you take any heat from your teammates or other guys in the NBA for your activism?
I'm being called diplomat as we speak now for this year. That's the new line. So I take it as a compliment, because I have spoken to almost all my teammates in some capacity politically. I'm also kind of one of the vice presidents in the union. So I talk to them constantly, and they know that I don't push my views in them. I more listen and just try to give them as much information as possible so that they can make up their own minds.
Adonal Foyle plays for the Golden State Warriors and works with the political group Democracy Matters. Adonal, thank you very much for speaking with me.
The pleasure is mine. Thank you for having me.
It's nearly impossible to read a sports magazine or check out a sports website without stumbling across a story of an athlete who's overcome adversity. Reporter Greg Eklund recently spent time with the University of Wyoming men's cross-country team, and he reports that few, if any, teams have experienced difficulties like the ones the Cowboys have had over the last 3 years.
We'll go out as you come through the mile mark here.
On October 15th, Wyoming cross-country coach Randy Cole laid out a plan for his runners the day before the University of Arkansas's Chili Pepper Invitational, a major track event for distance runners from more than 30 colleges. Cole was hired in January to bring the University of Wyoming men's cross-country team back to the Cowboys' glory days in the Western Athletic Conference. Wyoming won the men's cross-country title in 1987 and contended for the league title well into the 90s.
On the last loop, when we repeat backwards, we'll come through the yellow flags and come right up here and then turn back.
Over the last 3 years, this team has been rebuilt virtually from scratch. On September 16, 2001, a truck driven by University of Wyoming senior Clinton Haskins veered into the northbound lane of Highway 287 near the Wyoming-Colorado border and rammed into the vehicle carrying the eight distance runners, killing them instantly. Haskins, who admitted to being drunk at that time, is currently serving a sentence of 14 to 20 years in a Wyoming prison. Randy Cole knew from the outset that his new job would bring unique and difficult challenges.
And we're just trying to kind of find a way with themselves and wanting to do well and try to overcome that situation and still have a good, strong remembrance of their friends that they lost and keep that going, but also, you know, try to honor their friends by getting better.
To do that, Cole has tried to develop a core of newcomers whom he feels will provide a bright future for the cross-country program. Among them, sophomore Chris Chabran has taken the biggest step forward. At the Rocky Mountain Shootout last month in Boulder, Colorado, Chabran was the third best runner on the team behind two juniors. Chabran lost his older brother Nick in the wreck 3 years ago.
In high school, I was really looking forward to coming up and running with my brother and the team. But, you know, after the accident, I didn't change my mind. I still wanted to run for UW. And in a way, I think it's helped me a lot to do something. It's definitely a rebuilding process, and I was glad that I could help out, you know, any way that I could with that.
Matt Hudson, who was a freshman in 2001, is more accustomed to running 800 meters or a mile, not 4 or 5 miles. After the 2001 tragedy, Hudson, now a junior, has been asked to make the transition ever since the accident to longer distances.
We had to deal with what happened and go through that, and then as years have gone by, it's kind of, we keep making progress, so we're starting to be competitive again, and that's what matters.
Obviously, this is a great opportunity, and look like the last several weeks are starting to come around with some good workouts and everything. So now,
as Cole prepped his team the night before the Chili Pepper Invitational, he knew the meet would also be a good gauge for his recent top performer, Brian Knight, a junior from Boise, Idaho. While the team is a long shot to qualify for November's NCAA National Championships, Knight has a chance to represent Wyoming as an individual. But Knight got off to a slow start this season. The last thing Cole wanted to hear was the news of an auto accident, yet that's what happened late in the summer when Knight fell asleep at the wheel driving to Montana.
Yeah, that was kind of scary. I mean, he was kind of apologizing that, you know, he got an accident, and I said, hey, I'm glad, you know, you're all right. That's the main concern.
Way to go, Knight! Way to go, Knight!
Come on, Brian!
30:46, excellent.
You did, I don't think super. I broke 31, but I came close.
Yeah, you did 30:46.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Woo. All right, coach. Huh? Now I'm running well.
On October 16th, Knight finished 24th in a field of 254 runners. As a team, Wyoming finished 16th out of 30 teams. After this weekend's Mountain West Conference meet, the Wyoming men's cross-country team will compete at the NCAA Mountain Regionals on November 13th in Fort Collins, Colorado. To get there from Laramie, the team will travel on Highway 287, crossing the same spot where the fatal accident occurred 3 years ago. For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in Fayetteville, Arkansas.
That was looking good at 5 miles.
Today in Grand Prairie, Texas, the Breeders' Cup World Thoroughbred Championships will take place at Lone Star Park. This particular day at the races is one of only a handful of occasions upon which thoroughbred horse racing attracts the decidedly divided attention of those who follow our many games. In the Home Run Horse, subtitled Inside America's Billion-Dollar Racehorse Industry and the High-Stakes Dreams That Fuel It, Glennie Kane discusses, among other things, the mix of money, savvy, and luck that it takes to get a horse to the starting gate for any race, let alone one the public notices. Glennie Kane joins me now from the studios of WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky. Welcome to Only a Game.
Hi, thanks.
You write at one point that the critical quality of a home run horse is the capacity to generate money at the track and value elsewhere. Can you pick a particular home run horse and explain how the second part of that process works?
Yes. In fact, there's a great current example in Smarty Jones, who, of course, won the 2004 Kentucky Derby and Preakness. It cost about $10,000 to actually breed that horse. His owners, Roy and Pat Chapman, bred him themselves and bred him off of a $10,000 stud fee that they used on a mare that they already owned. But he went on to be an undefeated Derby winner. He then went on to win the Preakness. And by that point, his stud value had escalated to such an extent that they were able to strike, after the Belmont Stakes, a $39 million stud deal for him. Now, that is a serious home run horse when you bought him for the price of, you know, essentially a Toyota Tercel and can turn him into a $39 million company. Now, that's only the stud deal. And that's his total value. He was actually the money that they got was somewhat less because they kept a portion of him themselves. And that was a smart move because now they'll be charging $100,000 stud fees. That's each mayor will have to pay $100,000 for a meeting with Smarty Jones during his breeding career.
Mm-hmm.
And they will get a percentage of that. So he will make money for them throughout his stud career. And even if he turns out to be a flop at stud, they can sell him for a fair amount of money onto another market, perhaps a smaller market. So he has now become a company.
Regarding the process of acquiring a promising horse, Satish Sanand, currently a big player in that game, says, quote, "There is no logic at all. It's love, it's ego. I don't know why, but you just get stupid." What makes somebody at a horse auction get stupid?
I think it's the competition. These people tend to be very competitive. They want to win. And I think to a certain extent, when they get into that auction ring and there is the object of their desire in the ring to be bid on, that is the horse that they've studied, they've looked at its pedigree, they've had their veterinarians go over it, they have had their trainer go over it, they want that horse. And when the horse walks into the auction ring and everybody begins to bid, I think there's an element of a feeling that that horse is meant for them, they want it, and by golly, they're going to get it. And I think when they begin to have rivals come up, they try very hard to shake those rivals off, and I think sometimes they can lose their heads.
This, despite the fact that, let's take another horse, for example, Funny Side, sold as a yearling for $22,000, and yet here are people paying millions and millions of dollars for horses that they just fall in love with.
That's right, and to me, that's really the beauty of the game, and I think a lot of owners learn this the hard way. Satish Sanand was a good example. He told me that when he first got into the game, he thought, well, this is a very easy game. All you have to do is spend a lot of money and buy the best horses, and then you win all the races. And it seems on the surface as if that might be true, but as Funny Side, it really illustrates well, and so does Smarty Jones. There are so many other elements that are completely uncontrollable that come into it. Funny Side's great rival in the Kentucky Derby, the horse that at the time was considered to be the one that should win it, was a horse named Empire Maker. They both ran in the same prep race before the Kentucky Derby, and Empire Maker came out with a sore foot. Mm. And that was just luck as much as anything, and he did not win the Derby, and Funny Side did.
Glennie, there is a tension built into the racing business. For economic reasons, a lot of horses are retired to stud when they could certainly still run. They're healthy enough and young enough. Would the business be healthier if the champions ran longer?
You know, it's a tough question to answer, really. It's almost a chicken and egg kind of question. It's hard to tell an owner, and again, the Chapmans with Smarty Jones are a perfect example. Their horse did not have an injury that would have precluded him from running the following year, or at least that's what the veterinarian said when the horse was retired at three. But when they have a $39 million deal that they've signed for this horse, it's very difficult to say to them, you know, you shouldn't take that money. You should let him run another year for the love of the fans. But the fact of the matter is, the way the economy of the game is at the moment, and the way this is a cyclical thing, so it's been this way in the past as well, the game is so healthy from the breeding standpoint that when stud farms go to try to acquire stallions, they can pay top dollar. And that is not necessarily a bad thing for the business either. It certainly isn't bad for the breeders. If those horses are worth more money to be sold, if the offspring is worth more money to be sold, that's healthy from their end. But you're right, there is a built-in tension. Where they connect is if the fans were to leave the sport in droves, if nobody wagered on racing anymore, then the percentage of money out of every wagering dollar that goes to the purses the horses run for would evaporate. So we have to always maintain a focus on keeping the fans in the game if we're going to see the game really thrive.
All right, this has been very informative and quite interesting, Glennie, but I think it's time we get to the real point of any conversation about horse racing. Have you got a lock for us in any of the Breeders' Cup races?
I would hope after reading this book, the one thing that you would have learned is that there's no such thing as a lock. You know, when you can spend $1 million buying a horse, you know, you can have a billion-dollar industry with million-dollar pedigrees, and, you know, your horse goes and runs through a fence and dies, you know. There is no such thing as a lock. I'm afraid I don't have a lock for you, but I will say that I am rooting for Funny Side in the Classic. I love that horse, and I hope he wins it. I would love to see him do it.
Glennie Kane writes for the Daily Racing Form. Her book is The Home Run Horse, Inside America's Billion-Dollar Racehorse Industry and the High-Stakes Dreams That Fuel It, published by Daily Racing Form Press. She joined me from WUKY in Lexington, Kentucky. Glennie, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you, and have a good Breeders' Cup Day.
When you wake, you shall take all the pretty little horses, blacks and bays, dapples and grays, coach and six little horses.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, snowmobilers who regard snow as expendable. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Seen any good ball games lately?
I am the world's daddy, ladies and gentlemen.
On June 10th, 2005, the Red Sox will travel to Wrigley Field for a series against the Cubs. I think that'll be a lot of fun, but my fear is that this series will prompt more curse talk from the witless. Do you share my concern?
Well, let's have them all move to Chicago now, because the remarkable thing about when you study the numbers, as we all did this week when the Red Sox finally won, their drought between world championships was only the third longest existing in baseball, the other two being the two Chicago teams.
Yeah, but Babe Ruth didn't play for the two Chicago teams at any point, so
As a matter of fact, I learned this week that the 1918 World Series, the last one the Red Sox won, in which they beat the Chicago Nationals, they played that in Comiskey Park because Wrigley wasn't big enough yet.
Despite the excitement resulting from the Red Sox winning their first World Series since 1918, Boston pitcher Curt Schilling kept his personal priorities straight on Good Morning America. On Thursday morning, he endorsed George Bush. You think that hurts or helps W?
I'm not exactly sure, but he was supposed to go, one hates to use this phrase in regards to Curt, but let's use it anyway, he was supposed to go stumping in New Hampshire for the president, and then decided that while he would have been medically capable of pitching a baseball game, if need be, this weekend, he isn't capable of standing up and eating chicken off a dish. I suspect that when he announced his intentions, perhaps Larry Lucchino and Theo Epstein suggested that maybe campaigning against the junior senator of the state in which the ball club is located, who might be president of the United States, very, very soon wouldn't be the best public relations in the world. And maybe, Curt, your ankle's hurting a little bit.
Yeah, it might have been it. The ball that Barry Bonds hit for home run number 700 was auctioned off on Overstock.com this week. Somebody got it for $804,129. Unless they didn't, I understand various lawyers may have something to say about the disposition of that particular baseball.
Yeah, the ongoing lawsuit over whether or not Steve Williams, the guy who wound up with the ball and swiped it from someone else, continues apace. This is all very tangled and very extraordinarily silly.
Well, the only thing that makes this particular "it's my ball, no, it's my ball" story kind of intriguing to me is that the guy who didn't get the baseball maintains that he had possession by clasping it between his feet.
Be holding it behind his knees.
Yeah, that doesn't work on the ball field.
No, it actually doesn't work in football or basketball or baseball. You're right.
Meanwhile, there is less doubt about the fate of the ball involved in the final out of the just-completed World Series. It sounds as if Sox first baseman Doug Mientkiewicz will hang on to that one.
Yeah, he put it in what he has described as the Polish death grip.
That has no chance.
Which doesn't, I've never heard of, but doesn't sound good, and certainly doesn't sound breakable.
At least 65 major leaguers were glad to see a World Series sweep because that means they could file for free agency on Thursday.
Gentlemen, start your accountants.
Exactly. Do all 65 go to the Yankees?
I think all 65 of them are on the Red Sox, aren't they? The interesting thing, of course, about the Red Sox World Championship is the flexibility and the hot stove league intrigue that's going to go on as to which of the Red Sox players will be Red Sox at the time they get their
World Championship rings next April 11th against in a home game against the Yankees.
Absolutely.
For my money, and it's not my money, they have to keep Jason Varitek and one of the pitchers.
The NBA season begins on Tuesday.
We're
looking forward to another year of Piston-style basketball.
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to what may happen in Washington with the five singles nights,
yes.
Including such gimmicks as speed dating, breaking the ice, and an ability to win a date with a Wizards player, a Wizards dance team member, or a member of the Baltimore Ravens.
I love that. Now, at the meeting where this particular plan surfaced, do you suppose that anybody spoke up about what might go wrong?
Or for taste? No, we don't. We don't speak of such things.
No, this is pro sports after all. That was really not an issue. Basketball and football coaches shuttle between the pros and the all-but-pro college programs all the time, Charlie. But how often does a guy who left a college job for a pro job return to the same college job? I give you Steve Spurrier.
Well, yes, and this is because, of course, partisans of big-time college football are all delusional lunatics. Poor Ron Zook, who succeeded Steve Spurrier when Steve Spurrier, you know, went off to fail with the Washington Redskins, never had a chance from day one. There was a website called Ron Zook Must Go that was the domain name was purchased or whatever 3 days after the press conference. Things have gone extremely bad for Ron this year. He's got a talented team which seems to be quitting on him. And now, of course, the alumni are calling for Spurrier to come back. And Spurrier being Spurrier, I'm sure, is not only listening to it, but probably throwing his voice out his luxury condo window into whatever mobs are moving on Gainesville.
On Tuesday night, Major League Soccer Commissioner Don Garber said, quote, "Our goal is not to be one of the major leagues. Our goal is to be the number one major league in the country." Do you suppose that that was what Robert Browning had in mind when he suggested that a man's reach should in fact exceed his grasp?
I think Don Garber should set his sights on being the leading professional sports team in Columbus before he starts working on the rest of the major metropolitan area.
Finally, Charlie, Garforth Town, a non-league soccer team in Great Britain, has signed Socrates, the Brazilian player who led his country to two World Cups but retired 14 years ago.
He's also somewhere between 50 and 200 years old, right? I mean, people aren't sure. Simon Clifford, who owns and manages Garforth Town, said it's a fantastic coup. Our fans will be pinching themselves when they see Socrates running out. I'll bet they will.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and engages in choice dialogue with me each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
I am the daddy, my friends.
Should you feel the inclination to send Only a Game a message, learn more about the program, or perhaps listen to the odd Only a Game that you've missed, visit our website, onlyagame.org. Each October, more than 20,000 people gather in Fremont, New Hampshire, for one of the biggest snowmobile events of the year. Earlier this month, racers took advantage of dry ground and wet water at the New Hampshire Snowmobile Association's Grass Drags and Watercross Championship. Only a Game's Karen Given attended, and she has our report.
Walking the cow pastures of Peterson's Farm in Fremont, New Hampshire, is the perfect way to spend a fall day. Crisp air, warm sun, gently falling autumn leaves, and the unmistakable whine of snowmobile engines struggling to carry their mounts over dry ground. Four massive snowmobiles line up in front of a computerized starting system as the ground shakes under their combined 1,000 horsepower. The fastest sleds will make it down the 500-foot track in just over 4.3 seconds. That's 118 miles per hour.
Go start 800. Tap two to the final. Lane number one is first, two is second, three is third, one, two, and three.
Grass drags are more than 20 years old, started by some thrifty folks who didn't want to watch their snowmobiles waste away in the garage through the summer and fall. Of course, today, drivers have modified their sleds to go faster on grass, making them too slow in the snow, which means they watch them waste away in the winter and spring. Racing a fast sled down a short track is only one of the modifications serious racers Pacers have determined to be snow optional.
This is really three areas where they're taking snowmobiles and doing what they're not designed for.
Organizer Dave Copeland puts every acre of this farm to good use, including the normally serene Peterson's Pond.
First, they drag race across the water around 650 feet. Then they do ovals around a pond, and on some of the straightaways they get going as much as 65, 70 miles an hour. And then what's new this year is we have freestyle snowmobiles that go off jumps, much like motocross, and do Supermans. They're going to try and do a 360 today.
If you haven't been paying attention to the evolution of snowmobile racing over the years, you may not have noticed that racing sleds in summer or winter over grass, water, or snow has become big business. It'll take the track announcer a full 5 minutes to list the event's sponsors, a task which is interrupted only briefly for more racing.
On Green Incorporated, Angelino, we are going back to racing.
Signs of sponsorship are everywhere. Even the drag racers, the tamest of the bunch, wear enough logos on their bright-colored jumpsuits to make a NASCAR team jealous. All except 30-year veteran racer Lanny Benoit, who stands out in a sensible flannel shirt and felt hat.
I guess I'm a redneck. Don't believe in dressing up too much. Years ago when I used to race for Bombardier, they were always trying to dress me up, and we used to have a battle about that all the time. I used to tell them I didn't want to look like Captain Flash.
No one would confuse the thickly bearded Benoit with a clean-shaven comic book character. He grew the beard decades ago to protect his chin from frostbite. Now he races exclusively in the summer and fall, but he says the beard stays. He has a similar devotion to his favorite sport.
You can have the fastest snowmobile and still lose the race.
And why race snowmobiles? I mean, there are a thousand other things out there to race.
Well, that's all I can afford to race. Although we got $30,000 in that sled and $15,000 in that one, so I guess we probably could race something else, but I like snowmobile races. A lot of fun.
It's a nice idea, but across the pits, Canadian Sylvain Laflamme shakes his head and declares that nobody races snowmobiles for fun anymore.
The fun gets pretty old in a hurry after spending, 2 days out here pushing and lugging, and we don't work this hard on our full-time jobs.
As it turns out, racing is more or less Laflamme's full-time job, at least between August and October. To win, he says, racers need every advantage they can get.
Well, physically, there's not much you can do except to have a good reaction time. You got to be in shape, but it's not like if you're running a marathon, of course. But the sleds is very, very, a half a turn of a screw can slow you down where you lose, so you have to be perfect all the time.
Winners, even if they're not perfect, can take home decent prize money. But the real riches in this sport come from the snowmobile manufacturers. Like most of the elite racers, Laflamme works for the snowmobile industry and races for sponsors to cover his equipment costs. It's no wonder there's so much pressure on him to win.
This is a big business. It sells a lot of sleds. If they see a Ski-Doo come in first all day Sunday, it tends to sell Ski-Doos, and that's why it's so big now. The company's really put a lot of money into this.
Crew stock 800, round one qualifying, top two to the final. 800cc sleds, piped up some.
Dozens of classes will race over the course of the weekend, from barely modified stock sleds to barely recognizable behemoths. There's even the kitty cat category, with drivers so young that someone has to wait at the finish line to tell them when to stop. But asked to talk to a woman driver, and there's a little trouble.
Is there a woman driver right around you?
Yeah, there's Shelly and there's that redheaded girl.
Neither Shelly nor that redheaded girl were immediately available for comment.
Oh, boy, I tell you what, that first corner, Lori, is a killer!
Just across the way, drivers line up to do ovals around Peterson's Pond. There's something vaguely disturbing about a 500-pound vehicle skimming across the water when, by all rights, it should sink. But that's the point, says rookie driver Steve McKenzie.
If you like adrenaline at all, it's amazing. I ride snow sleds all the time. And, 100 miles an hour on the snow and all that's fun. But on the water, it's just something that's not supposed to happen. When your brain overrides the rest of your body's desire to stop before you hit the water and you do it anyway, it's excellent. It's just too much fun. Way too much fun.
For the most part, these sleds are stock, with water-sensitive components removed and quick drains installed on the engine and transmission. Most commercial snowmobiles have enough power to make it across a body of water, much to the consternation of Andy Collins' friends, who have been mocking his expansive waistline since he started water crossing in 1992.
You're too big to go across water.
Do you prove him wrong?
Oh, yeah.
Do you ever sink?
Oh, yeah. Back in the day, it was pretty bad.
He's a bottom feeder.
Yeah. He's like a scallop dragger.
Oh, no! And bad news for John Watson as he goes down in the final lap. John Watson takes the deep six dive in the final lap.
Within minutes, sleds that go into the drink are pulled out, drained, and ready to ride. It sounds easy, but it's dangerous enough to have been outlawed in some states, including New Hampshire, unless it's part of an officially sanctioned event. Collins and his friends say they've always saved their crossing for races like this one, in the warm weather, with plenty of safety equipment around. After all, Bill Best says, it's hard.
Anybody can ride it on the grass. Anybody can ride on the grass. The slednecks, they think we're crazy. Take a look over there. They're 30 feet in the air, and they think we're nuts.
They're calling us nuts.
Don't think so.
Here they come, it's the last hurrah, 2004, the after grass day. Indian Air heart attack, followed by hunger burning.
On the other side of Peterson's Pond, the aforementioned craziest of the crazies, the slednecks from Bozeman, Montana, pick up speed for their final show of the weekend. But announcer Jason Fisher isn't interested in getting into a debate over which snowmobile discipline is the craziest.
Well, it may be crazy in your eyes, but us, it's a way of life, and this is what we live to do. You know, we travel all over the country. We're all wacky for the love of the sport and to ride our machines, and that's how we live our life.
As the snowmobiles buzz around the double ramps that make up the freestyle course, Fisher promises the crowd heart attacks, Supermans, rock solids, and big double grabs. For those who might not know the exact definition of a big double grab, driver Chris Barant offers a simple translation.
We got 70-foot gaps, and we're trying to huck our 500-pound snowmobiles and pull some cool tricks.
There must be an easier piece of equipment to do that with.
Yeah, they're called dirt bikes, but I can't even jump a bike, so I need a sled. That's what I've been raised on, and that's, I don't know, that's what I do.
Frisbee out the water, Anderson charging off, big slip banger! Oh my God! It's going off today.
As advertised, the freestylers fling their massive machines into the air and pull some pretty cool tricks. There's not a whisper of the 360 organizers promised earlier, but there's always next year. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Gibbon in Fremont, New Hampshire.
I think he did that one. I bet he's fine.
Please help me. I think I'm falling. Gone overboard. Fast, only you can save me, you're my life preserver.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Monica Brady Meyeroff and from Alex Ashlock. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear this program again, sign up for our newsletter, or perhaps check out our web feature on snowmobile racing, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from legendary hockey coach, analyst, and historian George Carter, who offers perspective on Boston's World Series win.
Yeah, it's not as good as when the Bruins won in 1970, but it's pretty good.
Yeah, especially because so far this season there's no hockey. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
What have I done to merit this? It's so much more than I deserve.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.